1,693. And that's the world at 1:45.
Studio direction was by Peter Wise. The editor was Heba Ayoub. Now, in her major new history series, Professor Kathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, continues her exploration of our changing relationship with plants, past and present, in Plants from Roots to Riches.
A single plant can exhibit many forms. Its ability to do so is its ticket to survival. If one form is susceptible to particular disease or environmental change, another may not be. Your chances of surviving and prospering as a species are greatly enhanced if you look at the world with many faces. In the case of plants, a particularly successful way of doing this is through gaining an additional set or sets of genetic material. This extraordinary phenomenon may also hold clues to one of the great botanical mysteries, why flowering plants evolved so rapidly around 130 million years ago. It was the German botanist Hugo de Vries who in 1903 was the first to write about the many faces of plants. De Vries, as you may remember, was one of those scientists who'd recently rediscovered the work of Gregor Mendel. And as a result, he'd begun to question Darwin's theories of evolution. De Vries became convinced that species must at some periods have evolved in sudden bursts, so-called discontinuous variation, rather than Darwin's theory of continuous, slow accumulation of genetic traits. An abandoned potato field outside the Dutch town of Hilversum seemed to provide him with the evidence he needed. A cluster of evening primrose had established itself as a gorgeous escapee from a local back garden. De Vries observed it attracted immediate attention, even from a distance. And as historian Jim Endersby explains, something else also caught his eye.
De Vries noticed that among these evening primroses there were new types. They were only subtly different from the parental types, but they were definitely distinct. And what was interesting about them was that they didn't interbreed with the old types. They remained stable from day one. De Vries talks about the fulfillment of all my hopes when he found these plants growing. There were no steps, there were no intermediate generations, there was no struggle for existence in the classic Darwinian sense. They just seemed to grow overnight. One of the varieties that De Vries had found, he called Oenothera lamarckiana gigas, the giant. And this one was, as you might expect, much bigger and stronger looking than the others. And as researchers gradually figured out what was happening, they discovered what had happened was that the chromosomes in the plant had been duplicated. Normally, of course, a plant, the pollen and the ovule have a single set of chromosomes. They're called haploid. When they fuse to form a zygote, the beginning of a new plant, they end up with two sets of chromosomes. They're diploid, one set from mum, one set from dad. And each cell in the plant will have two sets of those chromosomes, one from each parent. These ones have three, four sets of chromosomes.
Quite literally, the amount of genetic material in the plant cell nucleus multiplies by a factor of three or four. It's a curious phenomenon, and it's earned itself a curious name, polyploidy. The word means many forms. It happens when something goes awry during the process of cell division, either sexually or asexually. This results in an additional set or sets of chromosomes. In practice, this means that within one generation, a new species can develop. In animals, these abnormalities are usually extremely rare, but in plants, they're common, and it's estimated that 60 to 70% of flowering plants have resulted from polyploidy events. As so often, different scientists approached a problem from different directions at the same time. At about the same time as De Vries was beginning to ponder this strange occurrence, polyploidy produced an intriguing case right here at Kew. In 1900, gardener Frank Garrett noticed a mysterious primula hybrid amid seedlings in one of the garden's greenhouses. This appeared to be a new plant, the offspring of two very different types of primrose, one from the snowy mountains of the Himalayas, the other from the sandy wastes of Arabia.
This new type, which is christened Primula cuensis, the Kew primrose, very attractive, unfortunately completely sterile. Now the enterprising gardener goes back to the parent stocks, figures out which ones they must have been, and manages to create more of these. And in the process of creating them, he finds a few that are fertile. They actually produce fertile flowers and they produce seed. So you can grow these. A number of women, Lettice Digby, Carolyn Pellew, Florence Durham, several of whom are working with Bateson at Cambridge, one of the first geneticists in Britain, they work on these plants and unravel the mechanism that allows them to become fertile. And Digby in particular figures out that this is another case of polyploidy. And when she publishes her first report on this, she cites the work on Oenothera as a parallel case. So lots of people are interested in this precisely because it seems to offer another mechanism of speciation, another way that new kinds of plants come into existence. And of course, they're very attractive, these new primulas, so they have a gardening interest as well.
One of the consequences of being a polyploid is that the multiplication of the genome results in a greater store of genetic variability. The advantages of this can be seen in the tobacco plant family Nicotiana. It has 75 species and a high frequency of polyploidy, giving an insight into how this peculiarity can contribute to evolutionary success, often in challenging conditions. Mark Chase, keeper of Kew's Jodrell Laboratory, explains.
In the species of Nicotiana that we've been studying, the really interesting ones are the ones that are found now in Australia. The greatest species diversity is found right around Ayers Rock, where you can find 12 of these species. It's just incredible. You go out into these dry areas, you can't see any vegetation except little scrubby, thorny shrubs and things like this, and then you'll see this leafy green flowering tobacco plant sitting there in the midst of this really arid environment, and there's no other plants around there like that. These are really specialized in this, but this is one of the things that we think is a benefit of being a polyploid, is they can do these incredible things that the diploids, the progenitors, the parents, couldn't do.
Because of this multiplication of genetic material, polyploidy plants often have bigger cells, resulting in, for example, bigger pollen grains and seeds. These features, especially combined with laborious chromosome counts, were used to detect polyploidy. Then in 1983, a process known as flow cytometry began to be used for the rapid analysis of plant cells. Typically, 5,000 nuclei per sample can be analysed in just a few minutes. As Ilya Lech, research scientist in the Jodrell Laboratory at Kew, describes, this technique is a huge improvement.
Here's an example of a run that we did when we were looking at ephedra, one of the non-flowering seed plants. This sample here, actually, which we measured yesterday, has about five times as much DNA as we have in each of our nuclei in humans, which perhaps is intriguing in its own right. But, and this is a tetraploid. We were running it to see what ploidy level it was, and we know from the amount of DNA it's a tetraploid. So we can go out to a population of one species and sample, say, 100 individuals, come back, run them on the flow cytometer, and see what diversity of ploidy is there even within a species. And it's been really enlightening, actually. Because we can do this, because we have the speed that we can process lots of samples, the studies are certainly showing that there's a much greater diversity of ploidy even within a species than was really hitherto expected based on chromosome counting, which was a very slow process. So it's been amazing to find this.
Rapid advances in new technology such as flow cytometry could help address one of evolution's greatest mysteries. Why, so soon after appearing in the fossil record about 130 million years ago, did flowering plants, or higher plants, suddenly explode into the bewildering diversity of species with their equally bewildering range of reproductive techniques? Showy magnolia-style blooms, multi-petaled blossoms fertilised by bees, or plants that cast their pollen to the winds? Over 70 species of plants and almost all the flowering plant families that we presently have around us diversified during this interval in time.
It may be that we can tie this burst of diversification to a polyploid event. And it makes sense, again, that this is what would spur this kind of process into happening. We have circumstantial evidence that there was a round of polyploidy and there was a really rapid diversification of these major lineages more or less around the same time. Given that it was only a window of 10 million years, it's really hard to be precise when you're dealing with something that's that far in the past and of such a short duration. but there are people that are working on this quite hard to try to pin this down so we can get a cause and effect.
Refinements and improvements to counting techniques have provided significant new lines of inquiry. As well as simply counting the amount of genetic material, scientists have turned to the sequencing of individual chromosomes. They've begun to observe a curious phenomenon: multiple copies of the same gene sequence, or indeed duplication of whole gene sequences within single strands of DNA. To researchers, these could be the smoking gun, signatures of polyploidy events in flowering plants dating back millions of years. Since when, as Mark Chase explains, much of the DNA has been completely replaced, so the fragments that remain are the remnants of past polyploidy events.
So a lot goes on. Most of it, the changes in their genomes, involve deletion of large parts of the duplication that was a result of that polyploid event in terms of what we call their structural genes, the genes that control the way the plant looks, the way the plant acts, its ecology and physiology. These are sort of housekeeping genes. There seems to be some sort of drive to get rid of this extra genetic baggage.
Meanwhile, some vital genes remain, and it's these that are providing a window into the past.
Other genes that are retained in the multiple copies are those that are associated with control of the housekeeping genes. And those are the ones that are retained. And this is one of the reasons we can say that we know that there was a polyploid event back right on the early period of the evolution of the flowering plants, because we can see the extra copies of these controlling genes that are still present in the genomes, that are retained. And the implication of this is that it allows the expression of these housekeeping genes to be tuned to the environment in which these plants exist. And we think this is very likely one of the reasons why the angiosperms, first of all, were successful, but secondly, are so productive that we can feed 7 billion people on their back.
Many of our crop species, for instance, wheat, maize, sugarcane, are polyploid, either through selective breeding or as a result of an earlier polyploidy event. So as we discover more about ploidy, it could be that we learn even more about its wider impact on interactions within an ecosystem.
Probably one of the interesting implications is the fact that although you may not be able to necessarily see visually what ploidy levels you might have in a population, certainly, for example, the insects are capable of distinguishing between individuals with different ploidy levels. There aren't many studies at the moment, but the limited ones show, for example, in some species that pollinators may preferentially pollinate only the tetraploids or may only preferentially pollinate the diploids. So in a mixed population with different ploidy levels, even within a species, this will affect the ecological interactions, and that will have a knock-on effect into functioning of the ecosystem. But there aren't that many studies yet, but I think it's something perhaps which needs to be taken on board much more seriously. Now we know the frequency with which there is this diversity of ploidy even within a species.
So understanding this strange phenomenon, polyploidy, which caught the eye of the first geneticists, is something that may hold the keys to the evolution of flowering plants, understanding plant-insect interactions in ecosystems, and quality and quantity of some of our most stable food sources. This is not simply a matter of pure research. Its practical implications are all around us, and as we'll hear in future episodes, may provide resilience to future climate and disease outbreaks.
That was Professor Kathy Willis with Plants from Roots to Riches. The series is produced by Adrian Washbourne. Christina Hendricks is one of the stars of the multi-award-winning series Mad Men. Tonight, in Front Row, she'll be talking about her latest project, in which she stars with the late Philip Seymour Hoffman in one of his final roles.
Because we're still very much feel like we're present in this film and we're talking about it and we want people to go see it and we're proud of it. It's sort of this strange feeling where I keep thinking I'm still going to see him. He still feels very much a part of the project, and he was proud of it. And there's inevitably a sadness surrounding it. It's hard to watch.
Christina Hendricks on Front Row this evening at 7:15 here on Radio 4.